Welcome back to Bad Gay Movies. This is episode 181, and I really thank all of you for taking time away from reading Brittany's memoir to join us on today's show. If I were to guess, I'd say we all want to read it because we want her to call herself crazy first so that then we can just go on making fun of her while pretending to be noble advocates for mental health. God bless Brittany. I wish her all the best. One of the greatest compliments I get on this show is when listeners who are people of note approach us and tell us that they listen to the show and want to be on it. And a high number of them are published authors. We have quite a few of them this season and last. And our latest is Scott Mainprize, who you will hear all about in the forthcoming episode. But I did want to mention him in my intro because his book, The First Few Feet in a World of Wolves, is available from At Bay Press on November 21st. There is a link in our show notes, and look it up on Amazon, Indigo, wherever you get your books, because it is available for pre-order. Enjoy the show. Follow us on the socials, Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, Instagram. Write to us, badgaymovies2013@gmail.com. Visit us at badgaymovies.com. Talk to you later.
Life is about to hit a low note.
Victor Fox was found murdered this afternoon in Chicago.
We have to talk, Grace. I don't want to be married anymore.
And just when she lost all hope...
What am I gonna do without him?
Sorry you lived with him for 25 years, but you'll survive!
Not Max! Victor Fox!
Welcome to Bad Gay Movies. I am your host, Bill Antoniou, and with me today, I am super excited to have the guest that I think I know the least before starting recording on this show, because he did me the wonderful pleasure of reaching out and introducing himself to me and his work and telling us that he loved the show. So my guest today is Scott Mainprize, a two-spirit lawyer, writer, comedian, sessional instructor of restorative justice. He's currently working in community development. His new book, The First Few Feet in a World of Wolves, is released by At Bay Press on November 21st. It is available for pre-order through major outlets and probably others as well, so look that up. Scott, welcome to Bad Gay Movies.
Wash day. Thanks for having me, Bill.
We'll get to the movie in a minute, which we are talking about, the very classic Unconditional Love by P.J. Hogan. But before we do that, tell me about your forthcoming novel.
So when I'm not ripping on Bad Gay Movies, my other life is as a lawyer and working in restorative justice. Mm-hmm. And so my new book, which I'm really excited about, is a way for linking what we often reduce to individual pieces of the colonial landscape over the last few hundred years and mm-hmm. connecting them in what I hope is a safe way of helping us all move forward on the road of reconciliation, regardless of whether we're directly impacted or colonial Canadians.
So it's a thriller is what you're telling me.
Right.
It's a rom-com.
It's a rom-com.
You've already brought more like serious subject to this podcast than like all the other episodes combined, for which I'm glad, don't get me wrong,
but we will make up for it.
We will totally make up for it. Now that we've stolen your land and fucked your wife, we're gonna make up for it. Absolutely. So that's wonderful. So that's the theme of your novel. What is it about, though? Tell our listeners what it's actually about.
So it's the protagonist who is two-spirited, and so the novel gets into the layers to what that means. But it's a two-spirited new teacher, so just out of teacher's college, mm-hmm. who moves up to the Arctic to teach, and it's their year of exploration about their own indigeneity, their two-spiritedness, as well as seeing how that's parallel as well as very different than the experience of the Inuit sister community that they've become a guest member of.
That's very cool. That's very cool. I'm looking forward to reading it. I read a book a week, Scott, so I will slot you in.
Wonderful. And humor is medicine. So it's serious subject matter, but it's meant to be a safe access point.
Well, I mean, if you're a fan of the show, Scott, you obviously have a very healthy and developed sense of humor. I'm not going to lie. We don't get any outraged emails. So apparently everyone who listens to this show is as disrespectful and evil as I am. So we're all good. So when you very kindly reached out to me and asked to talk about the possibility of being on the show, I asked you to give me ideas of movies you wanted to talk about. And we ended up zeroing in on the 2002 release Unconditional Love by PJ Hogan. Before we get into that, please tell me what inspired this selection.
A real gem, right? So I think when, and hindsight is so 2020, I remember this as a much better film. So I was happy to find that it wasn't. But I think that when I came upon this film just after it was released, the only other gay films that I had seen were Parting Glances, Bent, and Torch Song Trilogy.
Right.
So I think in context, I thought, you know, this isn't a great movie, but it's charming because it's not about AIDS, World War II, and there's no queer related hate.
Right.
So
the movie is the hate crime, but
right,
yeah.
The movie is the hate crime to everybody for 2 hours. So I was pleasantly surprised when I returned to it that this movie is bad from start to finish. I don't think I went 30 seconds without finding something new to be appalled by. But I think it also really worked after I decided to watch this film as the prequel to Misery. This is the Annie Wilkes origin story. So
absolutely. That works so well. And she gives up the wig too. Yeah. She's just like, I am done with this fake lace front where they keep scooping my hair over in the front to hide the, yeah.
Yeah, after that Sally Jesse finale, she's going to off the demon that's living inside Dan Aykroyd. And she's the next time she has a celebrity crush that she's confronted with, she's going to be ready. So
absolutely.
So it became a much better movie after that. But
that's amazing. I actually had the opposite experience because I remembered it being worse only because, and I don't think it's in any way good, because when it came out, I was like, with this cast and this director, and like the cast is stacked. And it's the director of Muriel's Wedding, which is one of my absolute favorite movies of all time. And My Best Friend's Wedding, which is like not my favorite, but it's a really, really good studio Hollywood romantic comedy.
And it's stole in the moment like 3 years before. So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And this movie is actually shot in 1999 and not released until 3 years later. So, you know, that's yeah. So of course I rented it super excited, even though I knew that it was a delayed release and I knew that didn't necessarily, you know, bode well. And so then I was of course appalled based on my expectation. I was thoroughly appalled by how terrible it was. So then watching it last night, knowing that I was going to be torturing myself with it again, however many years later, I guess I was expecting to absolutely loathe it, and it just ended up being really bad but somewhat bearable. I don't know. I don't know that I checked the time bar too many times. Also because I realized I'd forgotten a great deal of it. I remembered a lot, but I'd totally forgotten a lot of it, and I'd forgotten just how incredible the cast is. I mean, I'm gonna admit that I was obsessed with Kathy Bates in high school. I had her name written all over my binder.
Who wasn't? I
right.
Appropriately scared of Kathy Bates in a way that I reserve for expired mayonnaise. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. And you know, like what else makes you a gay teenager but being obsessed with like a middle-aged character actress to the point of writing her name all over your binder? Because I used to watch Misery on a loop. I love that film. And then Fried Green Tomatoes came out and it was just, you know, she was my world. And who doesn't love Rupert Everett? This might be the last time he looked that hot. Like, he's so incredibly handsome. And you've got Stephanie Beecham, who I always loved as a kid from Dynasty, and Sister Kate, Lynn Redgrave, whose line at the end when she says, "We love gay youth," is like the only reason to watch this movie because it's so funny. Marsha Warren is the other sister who people might have recently watched on The Crown. You have a Julie Andrews cameo. You have Peter Sarsgaard when he still looked like a young Jennifer Jason Leigh. You even have Biddy Schramm, There's No Crying in Baseball, in a brief role at the beginning playing the waitress from A League of Their Own. So you have all these people, and you have PJ Hogan. He co-writes it with his partner, Jocelyn Morehouse, who, if people know, all, you know, she directed How to Make an American Quilt and A Thousand Acres. She recently made The Dressmaker. They make all their movies together. They work on each other's films. I'm not going to lie. They kind of have a bit of a Baz Luhrmann and Catherine What's-Her-Name vibe where it's just like, are they straight? You know, and if and it's okay if they are or they aren't, I'm sure. It can be a genuine love story either way. But I always wondered about them because P.J. Hogan makes these very appropriate to our community movies. You know, The Breakthrough with My Best Friend's Wedding, Muriel's Wedding, of course, Unconditional Love. And then he goes on to make Confessions of a Shopaholic, which is like a bad rom-com for gays. So you have all of this, and then it's just incredible. And I wonder, I have so many questions about the production of this movie. What happened? Was it that the studio wanted a bigger star than Kathy Bates or a more glamorous star, and that's why he couldn't get it made under better circumstances? Because he's coming off of this $100 million hit, and 2 years later, he barely has a budget for this movie. The opening credits look like they were made on a Mac computer.
Oh my God, I've never done hard drugs, but I felt like I was dropping acid.
Yeah, totally. And it's actually filmed in Chicago and England where it's set, but everything looks fake. It looks like they faked a small town to cover everything in some way. And I wonder, like, is that fake screensaver look of the city around her building intentional or not? Because it looked like she was in The Matrix.
Right. And if it ties into this being a hallucination for this Grace Beasley character, then it works. But otherwise, yeah, no, it's so many questions.
And then just questions about this incredibly unwieldy script, which never decides really what it's about. The essential plot is that she is a bored middle-aged housewife whose husband leaves her at the beginning while she's on the phone trying to get tickets to a concert of her favorite Engelbert Humperdinck-esque singer, crooner, played by Jonathan Pryce, whose singing voice I've always hated, by the way. She gets to go to the concert, but he doesn't show up. It turns out he's been murdered by the crossbow killer. It took me a while to realize that that was a subplot, like the point where her guy at her garage in her building tells her to, like, not get out of the car or whatever. I was like, is this a commentary on Chicago? Like, is that what this movie's about?
It would have worked better if it was.
And I don't know how well you know Chicago, because it's a lot closer to you over there in Manitoba than it is to me, if you've ever been.
I have, but...
Okay.
But not super.
Well, I just wonder what... They keep talking about under the city, and I wondered what that meant. If they were talking about subway tunnels, or is there like a whole, I don't know Chicago at all, so someone's going to write me an angry email about this, like, is there a whole grid of elevated trains that results in there being an undercity?
If there is, I missed it when I was
there. Right,
but no, I missed it. I've not that I've seen it. I've only been there once though, so if there is, that works. Otherwise, it's just the Marauder plot for the Avengers before the Avengers was the thing. So this is a movie with 4,000 plots and none at all. And that's why you're the pro with the podcast, because I didn't find any.
Well, thank you. Well, I also wondered if they just meant the South Side. Do Chicagoans call the South Side under the city? Because then at some point they are actually like under, they go into what look like subway tunnels to talk to those people to catch him. So he is killed by the crossbow killer. So she decides to go to his funeral in England and meets... It turns out that her favorite singer, who has been crooning to lovelorn women everywhere, turns out to have been gay. She meets his boyfriend, played by Rupert Everett. And then they rescue the memory of this loved dead loved one from his homophobic family by, like, dressing him up in his mother's tiara in his coffin, which in a better movie would have been the end. Like, I thought, because one of the billions of plots is like the just be yourself, go for your dreams, reach out and touch someone, whatever it is. But then they come back to Chicago. It's important to the boyfriend to find his killer and get revenge, which becomes this like cat and mouse plot. I mean, it's again, one of those movies where it's like, what tone are you going for? Is it a satire? Is it a farce? Is it actually a sincere comedy? And then tell me what you think of Kathy Bates' performance, because one of the reviews that did like this movie said that she was the problem because she doesn't seem to know what movie she's in. But I've never had any reason to criticize Kathy Bates for anything in the past. So is she incapable of the kind of whimsy that this movie requires?
I don't know that this movie required a whimsy. I think out of the three protagonists, they all were playing in their own movie. So Rupert Everett, Kathy Bates, and the real treasure in this movie to me, the Meredith Eden character, Maudie. But
yeah, she's wonderful. She's a wonderful actress, and she's broken ground for actors of little of short stature, as she refers to herself, just because of the fact that she is has played a number of roles that don't require. Like, I mean, in this film, they refer to her as a dwarf, and they talk about how she feels stared at and all that stuff. But like, that's not what her role is entirely about. And she was on, I think, Boston Legal or Boston Public.
That's where I saw her.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's great to have her, and she is really good. But she's also this like out of control rage character who's like screaming at everybody. And you know, you have this plot about the bored housewife following her heart and being treated like she's insane by everybody else, which is sort of like a John Waters kind of thing. You have a Julie Andrews cameo where she keeps singing Getting to Know You to everyone. So again, what are we going for here? Is this movie taking place in the real world or not? Because I can't tell, and that makes me call into question a lot of the logic of the plot.
Right, and I think all three of those characters are playing in different movies, and I think they're all good in the movie they're playing in, but nobody else is operating on the same plane. So,
right.
No, I thought Kathy Bates played it well for what it was, and she really leaned into the prequel to Misery. Like she has a whole stalker section that she plays warmly. But I really felt this movie was written as an introduction to the gay community for the straight white community that might be familiar
right.
with Friends and Seinfeld and not too much else, and maybe the depth of the Rupert Everett character and the Meredith Eaton character were really just foils for having the straight life, midlife crisis.
But I question even that, because he already did that with My Best Friend's Wedding. I mean, that was considered a real breakthrough, that character, in the fact that like a guy could be gay and we could just love him and love his relationship with his female best friend without it being something that we needed to talk about in a serious way. In this film, Kathy Bates doesn't seem to need to figure anything out about gay, other than the fact that she's just, you know, suburban and doesn't really have much experience with it. And is shocked that like this man that she's had this very potent fantasy life with turns out not to have been available to her. But she doesn't seem to have any other hurdles to go, you know, to clear in that regard. And then the sisters are like full on farcical stereotypes of homophobic tight ass. And I also wondered, like, is this also a story about English versus American? Because there's a lot of that being referred to when she goes over there and is sort of sticking out. Kathy Bates is, you know, an incredibly talented actor. There's an affection she has for the Rupert Everett character that comes across that's the film's loveliest moments. They have a wonderful connection. I would be very curious to know what the experience was for both of them working, because I'm a huge fan of his, but I know that he is a handful. And so I wonder about that. This is not his first time being in a bad gay movie. He's been in two of them before. We have a lot of repeat performers as well, because Jack Noseworthy plays her son, and he was in Poster Boy, which we've done. And that guy who answers the phone for her to get through to win the contest, that's the boyfriend from Object of My Affection, which he would have shot like a year earlier. So yeah, my main question about this movie is that like, or not my main question, my main comment about it is that there is too much going on. There's this housewife crisis. There's a story of homophobia. There's an English versus American commentary. There's a tale of why you shouldn't meet your heroes as well.
Yep.
And then the pub scene, where they go to the pub and he finally has the nerve to tell everyone from his village that he wasn't the valet, that he was actually his boyfriend. And everyone stands up and cheers, offers a toast to the late Victor Fox. Is also a movie about not underestimating people. Like, is this movie cobbled together from 15 different scripts that these two have been working on for years and just decided to release this Frankenstein result? I don't know.
And we really don't get any depth to any of the characters to find right. that out, right? I mean, it seemed like with the Rupert Everett character, with Dirk, it seemed like there was going to be this moment of it where he's in the kitchen and he grabs the kettle and then he falls on the floor crying, and then we immediately cut away from that, what looked like it might be a catharsis point,
right?
Finding a bunch of straight people in the brambles.
Right. Because it's not outrageously funny enough, it doesn't make up for the fact that there is a lack of depth to the characters, because it doesn't take place in the real world. Have you ever been to
Have you ever been to a grocery store where they read out the news of a dead celebrity over the loudspeaker while you were shopping?
It would be news to me, and this would be a reason why not to.
Yeah. I have learned of celebrity deaths maybe from a headline in a newspaper. I mean, pre-cell phones. Now it's always via my smartphone and someone posting it. But, like, I don't know that... I've never heard the news, or like breaking news coming over a loudspeaker. So again, if you want to tell me that it's because it's this kind of movie, then it's not succeeding at being that kind of movie. Because then later, Victor Fox dies and they broadcast his funeral live like it's the royal wedding. And it's on every television screen in the airport.
Every television, yeah.
Live, everything like live to the second. So again, is it that kind of movie? And how is it possible that PJ Hogan, who does such a beautiful job of putting genuine drama into potent comedy in Muriel's Wedding, how is it possible that he is also responsible for this movie that gets everything wrong that he got right the last time?
Right. And so much of that, those scenes hinge on the Victor Fox character being somebody that we can find some sadness in, but he's the only character that we do get any depth on. And I found that very, very shallow when they're in the bedroom scene and whatever it is, sharing this horrible backstory, even though these are all real pieces of gay men's tragic family and coming out stories, it seemed very, very hollow and very, very fictionalized.
Yes, except I don't know that I connected everything he was telling me with Jonathan Pryce's performance in that character. And it could just be that he's the wrong person to play it. Because we're basically also looking at a kind of Liberace story where for some reason there was a fan base that man had that just didn't know that he was gay. And how could you not know? And I didn't get that sense of a secret life from Jonathan Pryce. Also, they apparently only paid for the rights to one song because we had to hear Always On My Mind over and over and over again throughout the entire film, which was not the same pleasure as hearing Dancing Queen over and over and over again in Muriel's Wedding.
Right.
Because again, this movie's overloaded with characters and their stories as well. And like, is something put to rest when we see him dancing as a ghost at the end? Was this movie all about righting the wrongs that had been done him? Because it's also about Kathy Bates realizing she doesn't need her husband. And it's also about the Meredith Eaton character and like what she goes through, and who apparently is so small that when she shoots a handgun, it blows her back all the way across, like she's a mouse or something. Right. I don't think handguns are that powerful, quite frankly.
I don't think the resolution did anything for any of those characters, really.
Right.
I mean, Kathy Bates, whose arc is in finding herself and finding her footing in the world, literally and figuratively, ultimately only sings on the Sally Jesse Raphael show because the monster that is Max chimes in and initiates it. The shoehorned in resolution for Rupert Everett didn't seem to match that character at all. No. A fantastic resolution for anyone's memory, but it didn't work with this script.
I didn't understand that. Like, why did the sisters come to that taping? And then why did they agree to everything he was saying? Like, couldn't we have one extra line to show that either was it because he was just shaming them in public and that they just had to say yes because they were on TV? Or was there a deal made?
Right, which isn't clear at all. And
also, why did they even have the right to question his inheritance? Like, by, I don't know, trying to take over the house by getting him to leave it? Because again, this is a kind of farcical subplot that doesn't make sense in a movie that seems to take place maybe in the real world. Because if Victor left everything to him, they can take him to court and question, maybe contest, you're the lawyer, let me explain the law to you. Contest whether he was in his right mind when he wrote this will, but like, you can't just like pull him out of the house and then squat, like take over, I think.
Right, and I certainly don't know British wills and estates law.
I doubt it's that different.
But there's no, read on that at all, right? Like, there's no read on whether it's a question of the legal qualifications for a common law sex relationship at the time, or if it's just the snarky sisters who appear to be the British mobs because they have two drivers waiting in the brambles for everybody when they come in. It's very, very unclear what the real argument there is. Maybe there's no legal argument.
Well, because their whole purpose is to hide the fact that their brother was gay. That's all they care about, is that the shame of him being gay, which I've spent time in English villages. I don't remember anyone being quite so narrow, but that's for them to take issue with that. So they don't seem to care about anything else. So then it's just like, so why are you suddenly acceding to everything? Because it's not that you wanted money. You guys seem to have money and you know, and they don't mention that. They just seem to care about the legacy, basically, of hiding family secrets. So, and then that whole, as you mentioned, like the drivers that they whisk away, those two houseboys that Rupert Everett has, we never really get who they are, like if they're his buddies or boyfriends or playmates. Like, I don't
know. It was very, very unclear. There were like 8 new characters in a 3 minute span. And
yeah, because they don't even both read as gay. And I just didn't know what they were doing there. One of them is played by Muriel's brother, actually, from Muriel's Wedding. That's one of the Aussie members of the cast. And the New Zealand actress Sarah Pierce plays the florist. You might remember her as the mother who gets murdered in Heavenly Creatures with Kate Winslet.
Okay, yes.
Wonderful actress. So again, stacked cast. Yeah.
And so underwhelmingly used, yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that floral scene was like the most shoehorned way of bringing the Rupert Everett character into the film.
Well, what is it? I must have been taking a note. I didn't even understand what happened in that scene. Why did she go to the florist?
She went to buy a wreath. Okay. And then decides that she likes the poem, which the Rupert Everett character has assigned in the newspaper, which right. I don't know that that's the same as putting it on a card. And I don't know why there would be an issue with two people using the same poem.
Right.
Condolence card. So it's a mess. And
yeah, because isn't it a poem that he wrote?
That's what it's implied. His initials are on it, but it's a very generic poem.
But why isn't that tied back into the fact that he was a songwriter? Because remember at one point he said, I met Victor because I wanted to write songs for him, and he said I had no talent. And it's like, why isn't that sort of the catharsis of that, which is that,
wouldn't you know, like to know?
Yeah. This is like a therapy session for me. This is the community outreach that you're doing for me here. It's a lighter day than you're used to. Not quite healing the wounds of a post-colonial country, but just a angry gay man who watched a piece of shit of a movie. I also had to look up Sally Jesse Raphael. I did not realize that she was still on in 2002. This movie was, so her show ended in 2002. So if they shot it in 99, she's still a few years out before being done. And it would have been released in England in 2002 when she finished. Apparently it didn't get released in the States until 2003, straight to video on like the Stars Network or something. So this movie was buried, understandably so.
And also, why use Sally Jesse in the instant? Why not use the Rosie O'Donnell show, who's somebody who was ending her show around the same time.
And who was friends with all these people, too.
Friends with these people. Yeah. Rupert Everett and her have this shared closeness to Madonna at the time.
Yeah.
She actually sings on her show and would have given them all these gifts and support that they were craving and don't get.
Yes, although I've never known Rosie, especially during the time of that show, to play herself. I don't remember her ever playing herself in a movie the way other talk show hosts did. She probably would have said no if she was asked.
And maybe if she was, yeah.
Yeah, because Rosie never liked working more than she had to. And it was actually one of the reasons why she did that show, was because she basically told her managers, like, find a way for me to make enough money that I don't have to keep working forever because I want to raise my kids. And I would not be surprised if she said no. Or because, I don't know, because I don't associate Sally Jesse with the worst of exploitative talk show hosting.
No.
You know, like if you want to make a joke, have it be Maury Povich or something like that.
Which then plays into the whole misuse of the sisters as well, because we know they know how to throw a punch in a public place from the funeral scene. Like they come in this talk show and are so, so passive in this.
And situation. Scared for some reason. They're scared into agreeing to everything and we don't know why. And I wonder, are there scenes cut? Because this movie is also 2 hours long, and it's the kind of genre film that should never be more than 90 minutes long.
If that, in this case. I looked at the DVD features, and there was one deleted scene, and there should have been more.
Because the point where they pull off switching his funeral outfit, his coffin outfit, again, I was like, why is there 40 minutes left? What else is there to do? I thought that this was the catharsis that we were going
for. Because we're both forgetting there's a serial killer plot, which was totally unnecessary, and we haven't gotten to yet in the film, and what was wholly unnecessary for the scene and a half. It was...
Well, I knew that it was unnecessary because normally I figure out the killer based on the fact that they have a high profile actor in a role who's hardly been seen. And that's usually what gives away the fact that they're the killer to me. This happened in that movie Last Night in Soho, spoiler alert to everybody, that came out a couple years ago. They have Diana Rigg in that movie and she barely appears. And I said, well, that's because she's going to be the killer. And she was like, so normally would have said, well, Peter Sarsgaard's in this movie. He's already of note. He's not like super famous in 2000 or 1999, but he's of note enough that they have hired a name for that role. And I just didn't even think about who the killer was, because I didn't think it mattered. And it didn't matter. I mean, we have the whole standoff with him at the end that is completely boring and pointless. And like, now we're getting into his life and backstory.
Right, right. And it seemed very much like just put in there for the sake of making this very deep cut reference to Don't Look Now, which
yes.
I hadn't seen, but was an extremely deep cut for a movie that doesn't have a film,
yes.
that doesn't have a plot itself. It's 30 plus years old and it sounds very, very moody and perhaps very problematic in its use of a little person as well, but perhaps uses it better than they used the Meredith Eaton character in this one as a metaphor for grief in that film. So it seemed like a very deep cut for a prolonged reference there. And then we see the only diversity in our film in the transient community, which we're also treating as clearly having mental health issues, which does not age well.
But also, why are they even there to find out what? Like, those people do not help them with any information. So why are they there, like, giving them coffee?
It seemed like it was, we have a little person, we're going to dress everybody up in their Avengers costumes
right.
for the scene, and this is some reference that is not connected to anything.
Because the info that we get from that scene is how they figure out that he kills people who sing.
Which doesn't add up, because he's already seen our Kathy Bates character sing. And
well, there's that. But also, why would this famous singer, who for some reason, despite being rich and famous, is looking for Dick in the subway tunnels when he could actually just have his manager send somebody up to his hotel room? I mean, people have done way bigger cover-ups for celebrities up until now. Why would he be wandering the catacombs of Chicago singing out loud if he's on the down low and he doesn't want anyone to know that he's gay? Why would he be revealing himself as that singer Victor Fox?
And these aren't even these secret labyrinth tunnels that we're maybe conceptualizing them as, because when Kathy Bates goes down, there's a bar there. So
yeah, there's everything. There's completely wide open.
There's a whole community life. So you wouldn't even be able to keep on the down low there anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if you're a celeb and you don't want to go noticed, you do your best to just not have any of the tells, basically. Like, you're not going to wear your sequined costume. You're not going to have your hair done. You're not going to wear your show makeup. And you're certainly not going to sing. And then when people say, are you that guy? You say, oh my God, people tell me I look like that guy all the time. So it doesn't even make sense. We did not need the serial killer. All we needed was for him to die in order to facilitate everything else, which it could have been that he was, looking for sex in all the wrong places and got robbed or whatever, met the wrong hustler or something. I don't know. There's so much extension of details in this film that maybe seeks to be original, but just comes off as incredibly messy. And then the Margaret Eaton character does feel shoehorned into me too. And it just made me wish that it was about something else. If it was just about mother-in-law and daughter-in-law on some adventure after being dumped by the husband without everything else, or getting rid of her and only it being about her and Rupert Everett. We didn't need all of it. It's such a mess.
No, I would have loved to see that film.
Yeah.
With that energy, but a different film than everybody else's.
Yeah, because she's so much fun. But again, she's also a bit of a farcical character. The way she like tantrums at people in public, it's like, that's not how a real person behaves. So again, what kind of movie are you giving me here? There's a movie from the mid-2000s released not long after this, starring Diane Wiest, called Merci, Dr. Ray. Have you ever seen this film?
No.
Okay. So this is a film that this reminded me of, because it is also about, it's She's, I think, a famous actress or an opera singer. I can't remember. It's a Merchant Ivory film, actually, produced by them, not directed by them. And she's in complete denial about the fact that her son is gay and has like a, I think they're in Paris, and she, I don't remember the details better than this because I haven't seen it in 16 years. But she basically crosses the city looking for him to find something out. And a part of it is just her like ignoring the fact that he's gay. And it has a very similar vibe, you know, like the middle-aged character actress just being eccentric as F and having a wonderful time doing it. And it's not a flawless movie, but it is so much more fun and so much more cohesive than this movie is. Plus, it has the dearly departed Jane Birkin in it and Vanessa Redgrave. So, you know, How can you go wrong? So I thought I'd bring that up. Don't Look Now is a masterpiece. That is Nicholas, what's his name? The British director who did Eureka and Bad Timing. Nicholas Rogue. That's what it is. Nicholas Rogue. So masterful filmmaker. Don't Look Now is probably his masterpiece. Its use of a little person is probably problematic. It's a very small part of the film, and it's the 70s, and so you just gotta swallow problematic whole in the 70s. It's one of the scariest movies I've ever seen. It's one of the few movies that makes my blood go cold when the scary things happen, even though, again, it's not specifically what it is about. It is a mood piece. What they're going for in terms of its connection to this movie is very scant, to say the least, but it's a really, really, really good film that I suggest everyone watch.
And is apparently getting a Criterion treatment this year.
It has already. I'm pretty sure I have the Criterion. I forget which movies I own, but I'm pretty sure I have that one. I've seen it many, many times, and maybe it doesn't scare me anymore, but it still works. It's based on a novel by Daphne du Maurier, who is one of my favorite writers, and who wrote the book that Rebecca is based on, the Alfred Hitchcock film.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, marvelous, marvelous writer. And it's the only, not the only, it was one of the film adaptations of her work that she was thoroughly in support of, like really excited about. It came out towards the end of her life, and she loved it. And she was quite vocal when she didn't love film adaptations of her books. Not vocal, honest, not, punishing or anything. Tell me what else you have in your notes. Tell me something else you want to talk about with this movie, because I feel like I'm...
Right, I guess, again, and especially to call it the underuse or overuse of Julie Andrews. I mean, we use her for two musical numbers, which the first one I thought worked really well, her on the plane. As a bit of whimsy, especially in the pre-9/11 world that
sure.
she was shot in, right? Yeah. A different read after that, but when it was shot. But then I thought like it was too much to pull her back in for the funeral and that energy. But then once you've gone there, why are we using Barry Manilow at the end? Why don't we?
Yeah, this movie wants to have it all. Yeah.
So I thought that was a confusing misuse of both of them.
What are you saying about Barry Manilow, that he's like your consolation prize when your favorite clearly cheesy singer has died, you know, who apparently only sings covers as well. There's no originals in the Victor Fox catalog. Yeah, I had that question as well. And also, like, what was the appeal for everybody? Is it just the fact that, you know, my best friend's wedding is still very close in the rearview mirror, and so of course the director of that incredibly big hit is calling, you're just going to say yes to anything? Because Julie Andrews, by the late 90s, is becoming very, not precious, she's becoming selective about her time in front of a camera. Now it's only a few years later that she just stopped appearing at all. Now she only does voice work. She is perhaps not well or just doesn't want to be seen at this age. I don't know. After this, I think she only appeared in a couple more things, and then like that Tooth Fairy movie. And then she had like a little, she had a show for kids where she like read them stories or something. I don't remember. And then after that, just never appeared again. And she's just been doing voice work since. So I feel like I need to know, like, what did you do to get Julie Andrews? Or is she friends with somebody involved in this production? Because I also don't know, was this movie given a sizable budget, given that a lot of it looked like, you know, you have these incredible actors, but a lot of it looks bad.
Right. And maybe there were so many offers extended, and then when they all came in, they had to find a place to put people and away from a script. But I think that's giving a lot of credit to...
Well, and also famous people shoot scenes in movies that get cut all the time. I mean, all the time. So I don't know about that, but maybe. Because I also wonder, I mean, how could the director of My Best Friend's Wedding not command a huge budget on his next film? But then again, studios will fuss over casting, and they will tell you, like, if you don't cast this person, we're not going to give you as much money. And, you know, Kathy Bates is a big deal, but she's not a box. She doesn't open a film. You know, she's not a weekend opener. So I'm very, very curious about that. And the same with, I mean, I know Barry Manilow is probably only there for a day, but still I'm curious to know. And I think Julie Andrews, is she wearing the same thing in both scenes? She might have shot everything in one day too. I don't know.
I feel like she was, but there was a lot going on there.
Also, they have her singing Getting to Know You, which she never did that movie. That's Deborah Carr in The King and I. Julie Andrews recorded an album of the score of The King and I not long before this movie, actually, so that might have been why. But it's not a song I associate her with.
Sure.
Which is also why it's an interesting... And I'm sure it's because Disney was not going to give them the rights to sing Supercalifragilistic or to sing My Favorite Things from The Sound of Music. I'm sure that was a much tougher get.
Right.
Because this movie is also not released by a major studio, which again makes me wonder about its production journey for a director who should have had a red carpet, you know, unfolding for him. He's never recovered the critical acclaim of Muriel's Wedding. He's never recovered the commercial success of My Best Friend's Wedding. He's never had anything as big since. He made that Peter Pan movie as well in 2003.
Right, which I haven't seen.
It's bad.
Is it?
It's bad. His last movie as a director was in 2012, which was a movie called Mental, which is a reunion with Toni Collette. So 10 years. I mean, and then he co-wrote his partner's film, The Dressmaker, with Kate Winslet. He worked on that because, like I said, they work on each other's movies. She hadn't made a movie in a long time, too. She wrote a book about it, so I'll read it at some point. But I don't know. I'm curious about these two. I want to meet them and interview them. If you go to Australia in Melbourne at the Moving Image Museum, what's it called? They have a whole display dedicated to Muriel's Wedding.
Oh, really?
I'm thrilled by when I was there, and I took tons of pictures of it. And then I went to another gallery next door, and Rachel Griffiths from Muriel's Wedding actually walked in and stood behind me in line. Because
Oh, very cool.
In Australia, you can pet the creatures in their natural habitat. All right, Scott, this was absolutely such a pleasure. I'm so happy to meet you and to have you on the show. Once again, tell us about the release date of your book and where people can find follow you.
And thanks. And Bill, this is such a treat. I'm a huge fan of the show. Thank you so much for having me on. So my book, The First Few Feet in a World of Wolves, will be out on November 21st through Appe Press. And you can pre-order it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Chapters, Indigo, and I'm sure there are other spaces. Thanks again. This was a real pleasure.
Oh, very much for me as well. And all the best with your book. I will be pre-ordering it myself.
Thank you so much. Make a wish.